Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We go behind the headlines with members of our news staff who have had a busy week. Joining me in studio are Justice Reporter Rachel Lipman, Political Reporter Jason Rosenbaum, and State House Reporter Marshall Griffin, who is in Jefferson City. We'll go behind the headlines with them all. Thank you all for being with us today. Nice to see you again.
Good to see you.
Same here.
Thank you.
Let's begin with, I guess, probably the biggest story of the week in many of our minds. That would be the consent decree in Ferguson. Jason, I'll start with you. Can you give me a very brief overview of what that's all about?
Oh, boy.
It's only 131 pages long. I know it.
If I had generally. And Rachel can probably give more of the details, but effectively, it's a binding agreement that will make Ferguson drastically change how its police department and government operate. And it also would have the city pay for a monitor to make sure that they're complying with the 131-page agreement. I'm gonna defer to Rachel to provide some of the intricate details because she read through, I think, every single page.
To be fair, I kind of skimmed through and saw what the big points was. So the city of Ferguson was pretty sneaky about this. They'd been kind of building up. We'd seen reports that, you know, they're building up. They're getting close. This was right before Christmas. And then radio silence for a month. And about 3:10, I think, on Wednesday?
Yeah.
Wednesday, this week.
If you want to go behind the headlines, I was on a bluff in Pacific, Missouri, covering a flood-related story when I looked at my phone and saw it. It came out of nowhere.
Ferguson just kind of slipped a tweet out at about 3:10 with a link to a website, their news website, saying, you know, we've reached this consent decree, and you click on the link, and all of a sudden there's this 131-page consent decree that's there. So,
but why did they do it that way? I mean,
you can speculate that they didn't want to bring the attention on it. It was definitely planned. It was followed up with a press release, and that, you know, they weren't going to be doing any on-camera statements. You can email any questions. This was not somebody rogue pulled the trigger and all of a sudden it was there. I think it was more to just kind of like slide it out there and try not to call as much attention to it as possible.
Fat chance of that.
Agreed. Yeah. But so, as Jason said, it's a very detailed, dense 131-page report covering everything from unbiased policing to protecting the First Amendment to the use of force, to municipal courts, to de-escalation, to
even use of dogs.
Even use of dogs. Just kind of how this is supposed to work, who you have to contact when you want to arrest someone from, you know, who's acting as a media, or have to contact a supervisor before you issue multiple charges for one traffic stop. It's a blueprint to settle some of those allegations that came out almost a year ago in the Department of Justice report.
Who actually did the negotiations?
It was a team from Ferguson, Wesley Bell. Jason, help me out. Who was the other councilwoman on there?
It might have been Mayor Knowles. It might have even – I don't know if Brian Fletcher was involved in it.
It was
several officials from Ferguson.
And a team from Winston and Strawn in Chicago. It's a big white-collar law firm up there in Chicago. And then from the Department of Justice, just attorneys from their civil rights division. They're not specifically named as to who – the exact parties were, but those are sort of the basic parties.
The actual decree, which is a draft document, we should point out, we can put that online so people can get the
It's already there, yeah.
Yeah, 131 pages. There's a lot to go. But there's a lot of work ahead, Jason, is there not? I mean, this thing is not a done deal.
No, it's not a done deal because the Ferguson City Council has to approve it, and I don't know if that's a slam dunk right now. From talking with people who were both inside and outside of Ferguson, I think some think that the consent decree is very detailed, very thorough, and could actually lead to lasting change in Ferguson. Others, such as former St. Louis County Police Chief Tim Fitch, found several elements of it that he thought were problematic. One thing that he pointed out was it basically provides no avenue for Ferguson to get rid of its police department and contract with somebody else, because one of the lines in the actual letter about the consent decree basically said that if they dissolved their police department, the person contracting or the entity contracting would have to follow through with the consent decree. So I can't imagine St. Louis County or Florissant would want to do that. So there's that aspect. And there just may be some hesitancy on the council to enter into something that's going to cost the city – hundreds of thousands, if not several million dollars over a few years, and could have a major impact on the city's ability to function.
I mean, the negotiations itself, they've already paid Winston and Strawn more than $100,000 for the work that they've been doing. I mean, Winston and Strawn isn't going to come cheap. Although, Jason, you and I were talking in the newsroom a couple days ago, what happens if the city can't meet its obligations to have a police department, mm-hmm. if, you know, it starts taking up just too much of their budget to provide any other services. And I think you found out that as the technical sheriff in St. Louis County, the county police would be obligated to come
that's
and
what
provide
Fitch,
services.
That's what Fitch told me. So the county would have no choice but to do it and would be saddled with this situation that they probably didn't want to be in.
And I think he said that what police chief wants to become involved with all these rules and regulations all of a sudden?
Yeah, that was another thing that he said as well.
Let me just see if there's a legislative component that Marshall can address. Marshall, are you getting any feedback at all about this in Jefferson City? And is there any action that you can see perhaps that the legislature would have to become involved with?
There's been very little just because of how suddenly this came out. I did talk to Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal yesterday in her office when I got her official response and recorded an interview with her in which she said she'd only read through portions of it, liked some of what she saw, and didn't like some other parts of it. That said, I'm thinking that early next week when the Senate reconvenes, we're going to be hearing a lot from Senator Chappelle Nadal, from Senator Nasheed, and probably over in the House. There probably won't be as much open debate in the House about it just because of the way that the two legislative bodies are structured. The Senate is set up to where, you know, where their arrangement is, you know, regardless of what bill may be on the floor, any senator can pretty much stand up and talk about anything they want, and that's part of the structure allowing filibusters to take place. But even when there's not a filibuster taking place, a senator can stand up, talk about a subject that has absolutely nothing to do with the subject matter of the bill. So I would imagine that at some point in time, there's going to be a lot of discussion about this, about the this, you know, proposed agreement between the Ferguson and the Justice Department. You can count on it being talked about in length on the Senate floor next week.
I think there's another open question about this document, and that is that the Department of Justice has basically placed a lot of power over reshaping Ferguson, but not the surrounding municipalities mm-hmm. in St. Louis County. And although some, like U.S. Representative Lacey Clay, thinks this will be a warning for other cities to maybe clean up their act before they're in the crosshairs of the Justice Department. Another person, like Art City Defenders Thomas Harvey, said cities are overjoyed that the Department of Justice just targeted Ferguson with all their might and none of the other cities, and there's really no incentive for any of the cities to change. And the question that I alluded to is, if only Ferguson changes and none of the other cities make any radical changes to their policing, does it actually help, you know, poor African-American motorists in St. Louis? I don't know.
Rachel, there are going to be a number of public discussions on this, public input. Mm-hmm. Does this mean that this can be amended? Are people just going to sign in and sign on or sign off and that's that, or what else?
I'd imagine that there's some room for continued negotiations. The impression I get from the letters I saw is that this, you know, no side is going to say, well, we gave up this, we gave up that. But it was clear that this was not just a, you know, we're going to go in and say, you know, yes, sir, this is what we'll accept and have at it. You don't hire Winston and Strawn, as I said, if that's what you're going to do. They'll take input, but their timeline that they're looking at here is just a couple of weeks in February. I think they've got two meetings scheduled for next week, a meeting after that, and then they hope to vote on it. And the impression I got from a letter from the Department of Justice is they want that done, or they're leaving open the possibility of filing suit. So I don't know how much of a choice Ferguson has of accepting this or not accepting this, because a lawsuit's going to be that much more expensive. You've got the whole legal fight leading to something. They're going to have to do something. There's open civil rights allegations out there.
My impression is it's a take it or leave it proposition.
Mm-hmm. There will definitely be a suit if, in fact, the council turns it down.
Correct.
It could be, yes.
All right. Any other final thoughts on that? I'd like to move along to something else. But
I'm sure there are other topics to talk about than just Ferguson, so I will pass.
I will say one thing I saw kind of as bubbling up on some of the activists, the Twitter accounts from activists, is they're not particularly thrilled with some of the portions where supervisors are kind of in charge. As they put it, some of the supervisors, some of the sergeants made some of the worst arrests during the protests. Yeah. So it's not necessarily making anything better. They're promising to be out in force. But again, as Jason said, said this may be a take-it-or-leave-it proposition.
Before we leave the subject, we have a call from Ferguson, from Ron. Let's bring him in, and then we'll move on. Ron, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, I just want to say this whole thing is a joke. At no time did the Justice Department ever survey the citizens that live and pay taxes in Ferguson. There are problems with the police department. They should have intervened in the whole St. Louis area about the hiring practices of police officers throughout the whole St. Louis area, including St. Louis City. The entire state should have been included. And just to go to Ferguson, which is the most diverse community, and they've never once showed any conflict, racial conflicts among any citizens that lived in Ferguson. So why are they getting all the attention when all these other areas, even by their own Justice Department owns data, show that 60% of the other municipalities are even worse?
All right, Ron, thanks for the call. Does he have a point?
I mean, that goes into the point I made earlier, that there are some who fear that just going after Ferguson is not going to make a lasting change in St. Louis County if other cities are kind of without pressure to change.
Ferguson was the one that flashed. I think that's if you had seen a case like Michael Brown happen in Delwood or Velda City or any of those other North County municipalities that have seen the kind of demographic change that Ferguson has, you might be looking at a Department of Justice investigation of those police departments.
Okay. Well, let's leave Ferguson for the moment and go to the Scott Trade Center story. Jason, you were on that this week. A lot of people have their eyebrows raised now that the Rams are gone. No billion-dollar stadium. The concern is, more public money perhaps for what's essentially a sports venue?
It could be. Just want to note that the Post-Dispatch was the first to report this, but they reported that the people behind the Scott Trade Center and the Convention Center wanted, I think in total, like several hundred million dollars in renovations. I've been to the Scott Trade Center many times for concerts and professional wrestling events, as I mentioned in the last Behind the Headline show, and blues games. It's a fine stadium, but I think it's around 20 years old, and I think that if I'm not mistaken, I think the Blues are in charge of at least managing it. They may own it altogether. They don't own it altogether.
It's a lease arrangement. It was very similar to the way that the Rams were a tenant at the Dome.
Well, the point is they want renovations, and if the Jones Dome is really going to become a de facto convention center, like many people have wished after the Rams departed, the entire facility is going to need quite a bit of upgrading, and that's going to cost a lot of money, and it could mean both St. Louis and St. Louis County have to contribute to
it. What kind of upgrades are we talking about? I mean, new restrooms or new tiles on the floor, that sort of thing?
I mean, that'll probably change over time, but my understanding for the convention center in particular, it's not like the flashiest of upgrades, but it's just things that need to occur for it to be a more attractive place for conventions.
It's aesthetic as much as anything.
It's aesthetic, and it's probably very practical too. And I imagine that there was probably some improvements done when the Rams were still playing there, but now in the Edward Jones Dome. Mm-hmm. But now that they're gone, I think that they want to make sure the entire facility is just, you know, ready for conventions, essentially.
I think one thing I saw is that the connection between the actual convention center and the dome itself, it's a very sort of not user-friendly flow into the larger convention space. So
that's
just to
thing.
Even kind of have it made a good convention space, you need to do it. And I think part of what it's going to be the issue here is what the stadium fight brought to light about some of the other units. I don't think it's uncommon. You wouldn't expect to, after 20, 30, 40 years in a house, to go, we don't need to update any of this. I mean, we're updating our smartphones every 2 years. I think why people are starting to raise their eyebrows is because it follows in the context of the debate over the stadium.
And some owners might say, hey, they were willing to pony up a lot of money for the football team. Maybe we should get in on it.
I don't know what the final price tag is going to be, because from what County Executive Steve Stanger told me, that negotiations are very preliminary, and I'm sure that they're going to change over the next few months and possibly years. But it would probably be a fraction of what a new NFL stadium would cost. You know, this is just the price you have to pay if you're going to have a public venue for a sports and sports teams and concerts and a convention center that's publicly funded. And it might be an easier sell if you can sell the economic benefits of both.
I have another question on this for Marshall, but we have to take a break. Let's do that. Marshall, stand by. We'll come back to you when we come back. We're talking behind the headlines today with our reporting staff, Jason Rosenbaum, Rachel Lipman, and Marshall Griffin in Jefferson City. We'll take this break and be right back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Rachel Lipman, Jason Rosenbaum, and Marshall Griffin. Marshall, back to you. Is there a palpable sigh of relief down there in Jefferson City now that legislators don't have to deal with a football stadium?
Well, I wouldn't say a sigh of relief, but perhaps a delayed, how can I put this? They're relieved that they don't have to deal with it at such an urgent pace. The issue, however, has not gone away, especially for Senator Rob Schaff. He was one of the leading opponents of Governor Nixon's financing plan for this proposed new stadium, which I'm guessing now won't happen unless, say, 3 years from now, some team wants to try to relocate to St. Louis. Maybe those plans will get dragged up at that time. But Senator Schaff is still pushing a proposed constitutional amendment that basically would... If approved by voters, it would prevent the House and Senate from providing any money for the leasing, upkeep, or funding of any new stadium after the 2031 fiscal year, basically guaranteeing that there would not be any new stadiums for anything until the current bond on the Edward Jones Dome is satisfied. And I'm guessing that might preclude any improvements to the Scott Trade Center would possibly get in the way of Representative Keith English's proposal to build a soccer stadium as well. So that's the issue has died down, but it is not gone.
Marshall, what about is there anything in there that would implicate like sports stadiums at public schools making upgrades to facilities there? Is this kind of a cutting off your nose to spite your face, let's tick off the two big cities kind of bill? And does this have a chance of going anywhere?
I think as far as going anywhere, it might. It might make it through the Senate, but since the overall urgency is gone, I don't know if it would really make it onto it. And even though the summary says any stadium, but I think the intent is for professional sports teams, I'm trying to pull up the actual legal bill text here to see what it says. It basically, it does say any stadium. I suppose some lawyer or judge could interpret that to be a public high school stadium, although I doubt it would get legally interpreted or enforced. As far as that definition would go. But someone could theoretically make that argument.
Marshall, it looks like we're dealing with the urban-rural divide again once on these things.
Perhaps. I mean, there's no NFL team wanting to relocate to Springfield or Cape Girardeau. So.
But rural legislators are not always disposed to accommodate the urban areas.
No, and there is still that mindset of, you know, St. Louis and Kansas City gets the bulk of the revenue. Where's our share? Well, you know, where's the share for our roads and bridges and things of that nature? That's still very much a driving force with a lot of the action that takes place here.
I think a bigger concern for St. Louis policymakers besides Schaff's bill is whether legislators are going to cut off the $12 million a year payment for the Edward Jones Dome. I alluded to that a couple of weeks ago, and from talking with a couple of other people, I think that it may not happen this year, but I think there's going to be serious discussions about it. I think lawmakers are furious about the $16 million that were spent on a stadium that went nowhere. I think they're also mad that the Missouri Development Finance Board gave their RSA a $3 million line of credit that they've already taken out $500,000 on, and they don't have a revenue source to pay it back. And I think that they found this entire situation that was driven by Governor Jay Nixon to be just a complete disaster from start to finish, that and that they just don't feel like they should reward with appropriations anymore. And I don't know how that would change how the Edward Jones Dome would function or be able to be financed, but that would certainly create quite a situation, to put it mildly.
And the city's already looking at a budget deficit of at least $4 to $6 million because they don't have the income coming in from the Rams. You'd have to think that adding another, you know,
it wouldn't
million,
be the city. We're not. This isn't money that's going to the city. It's going to the RSA.
Right.
But still,
but
it would still be
somebody's got to cover that payment. So if the city and the county pick it up, city's already in debt now because you're or not in debt, but you've got a gap in the budget now because they're not getting the income in from the Rams.
The point is, it wouldn't be good.
They got to be nervous with all the earnings tax discussion, debate, and votes. And now down in Jefferson City, Marshall, the earnings tax is an issue that's very current, isn't it?
It is. Of course, there's some people have thought that perhaps Kansas City would be breathing a sigh of relief, and I'm sure obviously they are. What I find interesting at the press conference yesterday, where it was basically just a general weekly wrap-up of things in the Senate, Kirk Schaefer wound up monopolizing a lot of the time. Well, that's because we did have a lot of questions for him, to fairly admit that. But he talked about the earnings tax, and I find it interesting that the reason why Kansas City was taken out was because of what he cited as Kansas City officials' complete lack of cooperation in trying to find some type of, I guess, compromise. Well, I mean, obviously, the Kansas City officials are wanting to keep that revenue stream going, and it just, in my opinion, it wouldn't be in their best interest to try to find some way to get rid of the earnings tax.
What they're talking about is repeal,
right?
Ultimate repeal, yeah.
Right? And so, you know, Schaefer said, well, you know, St. Louis has been more willing to negotiate than Kansas City, so that's why he decided to not go after Kansas City. And Joe Kevany, his response to that was, well, that seems like a silly reason
Marshall,
go after St. Louis.
Marshall, you said that the reason he took Kansas City out was because they were being obstinate, whereas St. Louis was being less obstinate,
that's
so they
right.
kept him in.
That's what I said, and that's what Schaefer said.
That seems to make absolutely zero sense. Let's punish the city that's attempting to work with us and figure this out by taking away a third of their revenue, and the ones that are digging in their heels, your revenue is safe.
I probably should have sent you the soundbite or the audio file before we did this show, but it is that was the general response of Schaefer, yes.
I think there are some who might point out that some things that happen in Jefferson City sometimes don't make sense.
I will concede that point. This one just kind of seems to ratchet that up a little bit.
Marshall, I wanted to ask you about the story that came out a week or 10 days ago about reporters in the Senate being kicked off the Senate floor and put in the bleachers. How are the reporters taking to that?
Oh, we're not taking too well to that. I'll admit that. This started, I guess, a couple of years ago when two reporters from the Missouri Times overheard a conversation on the Senate floor and tweeted what they overheard, put it out on Twitter, and that didn't go over very well with Ron Richard, who at the time was Majority Floor Leader. He's now the pro tem in the Senate, and he decided that this needed to happen, that the press corps should no longer be on the Senate floor where we could overhear, quote-unquote, private conversations, and considered it a breach of journalistic ethics. I don't recall that there's ever been any type of written agreement between the loosely organized press corps and the Senate leadership of regards of what is and is not allowed. I mean, obviously there are certain rules, like there's a dress code. You cannot bring in a coffee unless it's in a white styrofoam cup. There's little rules like that for the Senate floor. But from what I recall, there's never been an actual article of agreement as to how the press should follow guidelines as far as reporting from the Senate floor.
Let me ask the two reporters in studio with me how you guys feel about this.
Well, I used to be part of the Missouri Capitol Press Corps when I was a reporter for the Columbia Daily Tribune and a freelancer. So this news was sad from a nostalgic standpoint because the Senate press table allowed many reporters to develop relationships with staff and senators. And I think that this may be kind of an overreaction to perhaps an isolated incident. I'm not trying to defend the move, but I will also say when I was a freelancer living in St. Louis, I drove to Jefferson City often. I parked in a faraway parking lot, and I covered the legislature from the bleachers, so to speak, already. It can be done. It's obviously easier sitting at the press table, but I've kind of seen both sides of it. I have very fond memories of when then-Senator Chris Coster came up to me, looked at my laptop, and then proceeded to make fun of me in front of all my colleagues about how huge my laptop was. And I say that as a term of endearment to now Attorney General Chris Coster because I thought it was indeed huge. But that was just an example of, you know, being there allowed you to develop these relationships that continue to this day. I've known Ron Richard for a long time. I know that he is very principled in certain things, and I just hope that maybe he reconsiders this when tensions cool a little bit.
I can tell you that David Lee from the Associated Press sent a letter to the administration committee asking for a reconsideration, and from the best of my knowledge, that letter was completely ignored. There are a few senators that are going to try to persuade the Ron Richard and some of the others to change their minds, but we're not hopeful that that's going to happen. Now, they're moving us to a section of the Citizens Gallery up on the fourth floor. There's going to be a – right now the plans are to put us up there on one end of it and also do some renovations so that there will be, you know, plenty of room for us to work. So, you know, they're going to spend my guess is they're going to spend maybe a few thousand dollars to move us, and – it seems like it would make more sense to just, let bygones be bygones, save the state some money, and let us stay where we are.
All right. Rachel, on the face of it, I'll bet you don't like this one bit.
I have not had the privilege of covering the Missouri legislature as much as I've covered Illinois and Michigan. And you do see here realize a lot more from being down on the floor. You kind of see how the alliances break down. It's a chance for people to come up, talk to you, say hi. But I think the point I'd make is that I don't think there's a press allowed on the floor of the U.S. Senate. I think they're up in the gallery, too. Can be done.
And also in the Senate, you can't just go up to a senator while the Senate is in session. If they do that, you'll get thrown out. So there are rules that are already in place that I think pretty much all reporters follow. It's not an unlimited, you know, situation. But again, my wish and hope to Senator Richard is to reconsider this.
On journalistic principle, again, I've never worked within those rules here in Missouri, but on journalistic principle, you know, it's a new world. If you don't want the press to overhear something, don't have the conversation by the press table.
Well, you know, there's a legislation pending in Georgia in which they want reporters to register.
Saw that.
I think it's South Carolina.
Forgive me, I'm wrong on that. Well, you know what it is. It's basically dealing with having to register.
Responsible journalism registry after they report it. It's they report it on his travel, I think it was.
Exactly, yeah. Okay, our time is getting away from us. Marshall, a final thought, anything you want to get into this conversation we didn't discuss?
Well, I think we were going to, if time allowed, talk about a little bit about Nixon's legacy, and maybe the sports stadium issue was something he was hoping to be a part of his legacy, being able to get a new stadium and a new home for the Rams and keep them in St. Louis. But another thing that that perhaps is a bit of legacy building is this new state park that he is proposing down in Oregon County that actually has a lot of local opposition. There's a bill that would force the sale of the land that's already been purchased for this, and the reasoning behind it is that the money used to purchase this land should have gone to lead cleanup settlements instead of starting a new state park.
This state park is a place where the Beatles once performed, I'm told?
Not performed. Apparently there's a former ranch that's within this park area where the Beatles vacationed for about 3 days in 1964 during their first U.S. tour. Took some time off to just chill and relax on this former ranch that's in Oregon County.
All right. Well, thanks for clarifying that. We'll wait and see how this battle winds down. Final thought very quickly from Jason or Rachel as we close.
I would imagine next week will be even busier than this week, which was a pretty busy week.
Yeah. I'm going to go with that.
Same here. Busy as Jefferson City as always.
But it beats the alternative, doesn't it?
Being not busy?
Being not working.
That's true.
Yes. If that's the alternative, yes.
Thank you all so much for being with us. This has been fun. Thanks to Rachel Lippman, Jason Rosenbaum, and Marshall Griffin for taking us behind the headlines. Coming up next, a little advanced look at the Theater Circle Awards nominations as we listen to You Know Who. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.